Ansel, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, the Gospel Advocate, which originated in 1855, is the oldest identifiable thing associated with the Churches of Christ, with the possible exception of Ansel Jenkins. I couldn't resist. But I was a little taken back, humbled, with Terry Gardner's presentation on Daniel Sommer. And in particular, he was outlining some of the criticisms that Daniel Sommer had of the Gospel Advocate, especially in the patent medicines that were sold in the Gospel Advocate. And he provided an image of an advertisement that appeared on the back page of the Gospel Advocate for something called Vitaor. And it cured everything. It would strengthen your liver. And I just have to tell you, you didn't know this, but we are going to start having something on the back page of the Gospel Advocate that will strengthen your liver. What you will see in the July Gospel Advocate will raise your hair. Because I am inordinately pleased to announce tonight that beginning in July, the back page column of the Gospel Advocate will be authored by Cecil May. In making this change, and Brother Anderson and I discussed this at some length, we've been very pleased over the years with Brother Hodge and the work that he has done. But we do believe that Cecil brings a certain character that will be appreciated in the brotherhood. He's a man of great depth of biblical knowledge, but more than that, he has a Christ-like disposition. He has restored New Testament Christianity in his life. And certainly, I think it's appropriate, as friends of the Restoration Movement, that you know that the Gospel Advocate stands precisely where Faulkner University stands, and that our fellowship with all men and women of sound faith and goodwill continue. Wanted to talk with you just a bit about something that has become a bit of a fascination for me. And that is, there are times in our brotherhood when we seem to do things very well, and there are other times when we don't do quite so well. In particular, when you look back into the early 1800s, we find that the American Restoration Movement was just growing leaps and bounds. In fact, before the Civil War, or what, when I was growing up in Nashville, Mac Wayne Craig always used to call it the War of Northern Aggression. But before 1860, our fellowship was the largest religious movement west of the Appalachian Mountains. It was phenomenal growth. Then when you look at the Churches of Christ in the early 20th century, beginning at the time of the division from the disciples represented 90% of the brotherhood. We represented only 10%. But by the middle of the 20th century, we had eclipsed them in growth. Especially in those early years, the first decades, our brotherhood grew So much so that even those outside of our fellowship were looking at it and saying, this is a fast-growing religious movement. And I began to ask, well, why was that? Why did we grow in the early 1800s? Why did we grow in the early part of the 20th century? And then what happened? Why did we stop growing? And what are the lessons we could learn from the men and women of faith who brought about the phenomenal growth in those two periods? Tonight I want us to look at one aspect. The July issue of the Gospel Advocate is going to have articles looking at various lessons we can learn from those periods of great growth. But tonight, I want to talk with you about four leaders of the past and something they had in common. I want us to think about Talbert Fanning, about David Lipscomb, about T.B. Larimore, and about Marshall Keeble. Now, I couldn't help but notice this delightful journal, the Alabama Restoration Journal. And there's this painting of Talbert Fanning that graces the front of it. Talbert Fanning was the first editor of the Gospel Advocate. By the way, did I tell you, you ought to be reading the Gospel Advocate? But Talbert Fanning was the first editor, and he was known for many things. But something that is interesting to me as I've studied his life was that Talbert Fanning invested himself in the next generation of leaders. In his work at Franklin College, he used innovative educational methods that were very much ahead of his time. In particular, he shared his life with the young men he was training. Whenever they would study geology, for example, he would take out on a trip up to Mammoth Cave, which required quite a journey out of Nashville in those days. And on horseback and in wagons, they would go up to look these caves over. They'd camp on the side of the road and cook their meals in Dutch ovens over open fires. Spent his time with these young men. And in doing this, he shaped them and guided them. And he, more than anyone else, is responsible for the phenomenal growth of our people in the South during that period. One of his students would become the third editor of the Gospel Advocate. Talbert Fanning and William Lipscomb started the journal. Following the Civil War, Talbert Fanning reissued the journal with David Lipscomb, and Fanning very quickly turned the journal over to Lipscomb. When we think about David Lipscomb, we think about an author and an editor. But it's interesting, I believe one of his greatest strengths was as a mentor. You go back and you look at the Gospel Advocates of the late 1800s and the turn of the last century, and you find men connected with the Gospel Advocate who were given very substantial work to do. Men such as J.W. Shepherd, men like McQuitty and Elam, men who would learn from Lipscomb, not only from what he wrote and what he taught, but because they were with him and saw him, how he lived. And his example was such that these men influenced the Lord's church profoundly over decades. The same thing could be said of T.B. Larimore. In fact, so much so that whenever people refer to Larimore, it's almost a proverb of Larimore and his boys, because he was known for taking young men under his wing and working with them, training them, guiding them. The same thing was true in later years, in the middle of the 20th century, with Marshall Keeble. The Gospel Advocate I've gotten to know a gentleman named Amanzo Jones. Amanzo's coming up to Columbus to hold a gospel meeting for us in the autumn, and I told my elders, it's like Smuckers, with a name like Amanzo, he's got to be a good preacher. But Amanzo has stories to tell because when he was a young man in his teens, he was given the responsibility of being sort of an aide-de-camp to Brother Keeble. There at the Nashville Christian Institute, Brother Keeble invested himself in the lives of an entire generation. And it is not by accident that among the black population in the United States, the churches of Christ far outstripped the more liberal disciples or the independent Christians who did practically nothing in the way of evangelistic work among African Americans. But Brother Keeble and his influence lives on in vibrant congregations throughout the country and with men who even today are alive who were influenced by his example. What I see, in part, in those periods of great strength, of great growth, of dynamic evangelism, was a willingness to invest in the future. The slogan I've used as the theme for this lesson is that the restoration is a promise for the future and a blessing for today. My dear friend Jimmy Jividen, over the years, regularly would chastise me for referring to congregations and individuals and institutions as being liberal or conservative. And Brother Jividen made the point that you can be liberal in any number of ways. And he would say, shouldn't you be liberal in your love and in your mercy? And then he'd say, and you can be conservative in a lot of ways. And he would say, you shouldn't be conservative in your giving. You shouldn't be conservative in your service. He said, let's not use those terms. Let's refer to those who are restoring or non-restoring. Whenever we begin looking at a restoration, we think in terms of applying the New Testament pattern. And in doing that, our lives will be changed. But we must remember that even if we are blessed, as Daniel Sommer, to live decades with vibrant health, as we studied earlier today, all of us are going to be limited by the tyranny of the calendar. But when we invest in the lives of youth, when we invest in the training of young men to be ministers, of men and women to be godly parents and workers in congregations, when we invest in the future, we will see dividends that pay over time. We do a lot of complaining in the brotherhood about things that are going on among our youth and young adults. And many of these problems are very real problems that we should be concerned about. But when we begin looking, we need to realize that often, in fact, I would contend most of the time, it's because those of us who were responsible for the training of youth were asleep at the switch. Growing up in Nashville, I was privileged to know three of the prominent preachers. I knew Jim Bill McIntyre very well, growing up at the West End congregation and working with Brother McIntyre for 5 years there. I was a student of Batzel Barrett Baxter's, and I knew Ira North, although not as well. By the way, Ira North was an editor of the Gospel Advocate, and you know, he thought you should be reading the Gospel Advocate. I just needed to add that. But it's interesting that those three men, in different settings, but within a 2-year period of time, said the same thing in either a class I was attending or in a private conversation. They said, in essence, I made a mistake. I believed that everyone knew about the restoration. I believed everyone agreed on first principles, so I didn't preach on it. And the realization was, with each of these three men, that the fundamental principles of our faith must be preached over and over and over again. Because what good does it do to have restoration in one generation if you only have digression in the next? I appreciate the good, solid work that's done by so many. We need to keep on and keep on in training. I'm humbled that we have Brother Jack Lewis here. I'm humbled that we have Brother Earl Edwards. We have men who have invested their lives in the training of ministers. But we can't rely just on fine institutions of higher learning. The training of our youth must take place in the home and in the congregation. Parents must invest time with their children. And as Brother Gardner pointed out, one of Sommer's great failings was the lack of investment in the lives of his children. But also, we must have elders and preachers and godly older women who will invest themselves in the training of the next generation. Because the church is only one generation away from falling away. But the flip side of that is the church is also only one generation away from the same kind of explosive growth that we had in the past. The question is, which way will it go? And the answer will come down to, how well have we trained that generation coming up to share that love of the restoration that you and I have? Thank you all very much. It's a privilege to be with you.